This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
As more migrants come to the U.S.-Mexico border, they're being turned back by American authorities. On the Mexican side, the shelters are full.
Because of the pandemic, it would not be convenient just to pack the place.
Also today, the civil war in Yemen has been raging for 6 years. Now there's a narrow window to end it.
Rarely in life do you get a chance to go back and fix a big mistake. The Biden administration has that rare opportunity, and they should do it.
I'm Marco Werman. Also ahead on the show, the ship that's launched a thousand memes.
Don't go there, because the ship can't turn in the Suez Canal. It's blocked up for the foreseeable future, so be aware.
That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us this Friday. Unpacking President Joe Biden's first press conference yesterday at the White House, the talking points range from the U.S. economic recovery to relations with China and North Korea. Biden also faced a lot of questions about immigration and the growing number of people, mostly from Central America, arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. His message to adult migrants and families was clear.
They should all be going back. All be going back. The only people we're not going to let sitting there on the other side of the Rio Grande by themselves with no help are children.
Some families are being allowed into the U.S., but many are turned back, and they're facing tough decisions in Mexican border cities. The World's Monica Campbell has one family story.
For Eddie and his son, it's been a puzzling journey. About a month ago, they left Honduras for the United States, then rafted across the Rio Grande at the very southern tip of Texas, and were taken into Border Patrol custody. Then Eddie expected the chance to explain why they left Honduras, but that didn't happen. Nobody asked why we left, he tells me by phone, and there are many reasons why, including the low wages Eddie earns harvesting sugarcane, the hurricane that flooded their home, but more than anything, it's the gangs that rule the streets who want to recruit Eddie's son. He's 9. Now, they're in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, across the border from El Paso, Texas. And he, along with thousands of other migrants, is bewildered because he thought he had been allowed into the United States. We spent 2 nights in a U.S. Border Patrol holding cell in Texas, Eddie says. Then at 2 a.m., he says, they were escorted onto a plane with other migrants and flown 600 miles to El Paso. They thought they were going to a shelter in the U.S., but then after stepping off the plane, Eddie and his son, along with many of their fellow passengers, were bussed by U.S. officials to a bridge that connects to Juarez. We were told to walk across the bridge, Eddie says, who asked to use his first name only for security reasons. He had no idea where he was until he saw a sign that said, "Welcome to Juarez." People broke down crying, feeling deceived. Taylor Levy is an immigration lawyer who's long worked with migrants at the Texas border. She's heard more stories like Eddie's in the past weeks.
Lots of times the people have no idea that this was going to happen to them. They don't understand why they were picked for return while other people were released.
She says this confusion just makes things harder for people already in tough situations.
It means that they're using these Central American families, these vulnerable populations, as pawns in a deterrent strategy. So hopefully they spread the word and more people won't keep coming.
In an email, a Customs and Border Protection spokesperson acknowledged that migrants are being flown across Texas and to San Diego, too, to bigger border stations that can handle the background checks required of apprehended migrants. Then they're sent back to Mexico. Legally, though, people have the right to request asylum once they've touched U.S. soil, but that's not happening now.
We're here to this point where people have to have a way to be allowed to seek asylum again, because that is enshrined in our laws. You know, since the 1980 Refugee Act, people have the right to seek asylum.
Over a WhatsApp video call, Eddie shows me the tiny room he's renting by the day in Juarez.
Muy malas condiciones. No tenemos otro.
He points to a bare mattress on the floor. That's it, he says. He and his son are also sharing the room with another family, a mom and her young son. While we talked, the two boys kicked a purple ball in the hallway. Eddie says they're only leaving the building for food. Migrants can be targeted for kidnapping. Eddie has family in Iowa. Kidnappers could call them and demand ransom. He's also still absorbing the shock of being back in Mexico, and he's still determined to enter the United States. My son tells me he doesn't want to go back to Honduras, Eddie says. He knows it's too dangerous for him there. But they only have about $50 left. Eddie knows some parents are choosing to send their children alone across the border, knowing the U.S. must take in kids who arrive by themselves. Eddie says he can't imagine doing that, but he isn't sure of other options right now. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
As the Biden administration grapples with the situation along the U.S. border, they are also looking much farther south. White House officials say they want to address the reasons so many people are fleeing Central America. The highest percentage of migrants are currently coming from Honduras. For more on this, The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia joins me. Jorge, President Biden talked about this yesterday. What specifically struck you from his news conference?
Well, Marco, I got deja vu, actually, because President Biden was speaking about addressing the fundamental reasons why people are fleeing Central America. And this is something that he himself worked on when he was vice president back in 2014. You might remember that year we had thousands of young children arriving to the United States on their own. So here's what President Biden had to say yesterday about the root causes of migration.
It's because of earthquakes, floods. It's because of lack of food. It's because of gang violence. It's because of a whole range of things that when I was vice president had the same obligation to deal with unaccompanied children. I was able to get it slowed up significantly by working with the heads of state of those communities.
Now, Marco, what's interesting about Biden speaking about heads of states of those countries is that one of them, the president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, has recently been connected to three drug trafficking investigations by federal prosecutors in the state of New York. They say that, in short, he has taken money in order to allow drug traffickers to operate in his country. So now the Biden administration, in addition to those other factors that they're mentioning, can't avoid the factor of corruption.
Right. What is the Biden administration saying then about how they're going to deal with corruption in Honduras? Anything concrete yet?
No, nothing concrete yet. President Biden had a delegation come here to Mexico City this week to speak about the subject of migration. They didn't say anything publicly about how they would deal with issues of corruption or governmental oppression in the region. But if you speak to anybody who has done any research in Honduras, they will say that the State Department's policies under the Obama administration and under the Trump administration are contributing factors to governmental oppression in Honduras. I spoke with Dana Frank. She is a professor emerita at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and here's what she had to say.
First of all, the government of Juan Orlando Hernandez would not be in power today if it wasn't for U.S. support for the security forces that back him. And without the military, he would not have a viable base because they keep him in power, and they repress the people that protest.
You know, Jorge, it seems the Honduran president's connections to drug trafficking would be a special challenge for the Biden White House. What is the evidence that drug trafficking contributes to people getting forced out of Honduras?
Right. Well, when I've interviewed people who are fleeing from Honduras, the most common factor that they cite is organized crime in their neighborhoods. And in large swaths of Tegucigalpa, the capital, or San Pedro Sula, the largest city, large swaths of the city are controlled by criminal groups. But that isn't happening in a vacuum. I spoke about this with Adrienne Pine. She is a professor at American University, has also done extensive work in Honduras.
There's impunity at the highest levels for politicians who are leading drug trafficking operations and working hand in hand with other major traffickers and cartels. But also that impunity extends down to the gangs that are terrorizing people in their neighborhoods.
So, Marco, what I'm interested in seeing now is how the Biden administration handles this president that they have previously seen as an ally, how they handle that, because this is now part of the quandary that the Biden administration faces in Central America.
The World's Jorge Valencia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's turn now to China. Relations between Washington and Beijing have been frosty and now getting frostier. Accusations and sanctions are flying back and forth. European nations have also been getting in the mix, pointing their fingers at China. For the White House, the big concerns are the treatment of the Uyghur people in China's Xinjiang province and Beijing's ongoing efforts to crack down on Hong Kong. The World's Rebecca Kanther is in Shanghai and has been watching all of this. What's been the overall mood this past week in China?
Well, since those talks between the U.S. and China in Alaska, I've been seeing a real rise in nationalist sentiment and defensiveness in China. Online, in my friend circles on WeChat, I'm seeing a lot of posts about having a strong Chinese response to foreign criticism. And there's suddenly T-shirts and hats for sale online with pro-China slogans like, "Stop interfering in China's internal affairs."
Wow. So yesterday we talked about a boycott of the clothing brand H&M that was prompted by the government, but gladly signed onto, it seems, by a lot of Chinese. Are a lot of people paying attention to this, though?
Yes. That was because of a statement H&M made months ago about not using cotton sourced in Xinjiang because of reports of forced labor. And suddenly now, social media is just going nuts, and people are boycotting Nike, Adidas, and other companies that have stopped using Xinjiang cotton. And meanwhile, H&M has completely disappeared off of some of China's most popular online platforms. Of course, there's also been some more measured responses, like some posts that said Chinese people should be supporting people in Xinjiang, not just products from there. Every day of this week, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has been fielding questions about Xinjiang, and spokesperson Hua Chunying has had some real zingers. Today, she accused the U.S. of conspiring to destabilize China through Xinjiang. She warned the U.S. today's China is not Iraq, not Syria, nor is it the China of 120 years ago. China is open and honest, and the facts and truth will expose all rumors and lies against China.
Amidst all of this, Rebecca, China apparently also issued a human rights report this week?
Yes. On Wednesday, China issued its annual human rights report, and it only covers the U.S. Its very first line was, "I can't breathe." And it blasted the U.S. on systemic racism, gun violence, and the U.S.'s poor response to COVID-19. So I spoke with Sophie Richardson, who is China director at Human Rights Watch. I asked her why China would put out a human rights report at this time.
It is largely a propaganda tool. I think if the Chinese government was serious about reporting on compliance with international human rights treaties, which of course would be a helpful step in the right direction, we would see it be more honest about its own track record.
Rebecca, what do we know, in fact, about forced labor in Xinjiang?
The Better Cotton Initiative, which many of these brands are members of, has stopped sourcing cotton from Xinjiang because of reports of forced labor. And back in January, the Trump administration also banned imports of Xinjiang cotton. The Chinese government is having none of it. They basically call these accusations completely baseless. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson says they're using mostly machines to harvest the cotton. At the same time, the Shanghai Office of Better Cotton Initiative says it has not found any forced labor in Xinjiang cotton facilities in the past 8 years. Of course, it's hard to know whether the Chinese government influenced that statement. Richardson expects this kind of pushback is only going to continue.
I think we can reasonably expect to see the Chinese government go even further than it already has in denying that there are serious human rights violations taking place, in trying to prevent certain kinds of scrutiny.
Personally, I'm wondering what more is going to happen in the months ahead. I mean, we've got the Beijing Winter Olympics approaching, and I can imagine this is going to become an issue for global companies. If they choose to sponsor, there's going to be global pushback. And if they choose to stay away, then they've again unleashed the wrath of China.
We'll wait and see. Rebecca Kanther is the world's correspondent in Shanghai. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. 6 years ago today, a war began. March 26, 2015, Saudi jets began dropping American-made bombs on their southern neighbor, Yemen. The fighting has continued ever since. In a moment, we'll hear how it could possibly end. But first, here's The World's Stephen Snyder with the backstory.
The war in Yemen actually began before March 26, 2015. Months before that, a Yemeni militia group in the north, led by the Al-Houthi family, started expanding its territory. They took the capital and overthrew the president of Yemen, Abdrabu Mansur Hadi, who fled the country. They marched south toward the Indian Ocean, taking one city after another. All that happened before March 26th, when the Saudi-led Operation Decisive Storm began. This video was recorded at midnight as Saudi jets flew over the Houthi-controlled capital Sana'a. A Saudi-led coalition of Arab Gulf countries with backing from the U.S. announced their mission to halt the Houthi advance and to restore President Hadi to power. 2 days later, the Saudi military said they had the Houthis on the run.
We will continue to target their movement, their concentration of forces, until we clarify all the area that they are controlling now.
The Houthis, though, were defiant, threatening retaliation against the Saudis and their Gulf state allies.
We tell the Gulf nations and their treacherous agents that we will be coming after them. God willing, we will avenge for our dead.
6 years later, close to 250,000 Yemenis are dead. Millions of civilians displaced. Hunger, poverty, and disease are out of control. And the Saudis are still bombing Yemen. The Houthis are still fighting. And the exiled president, he still wants his country back. This week, the Saudis marked the 6th anniversary by offering the Houthis a ceasefire deal. But the Houthis have rejected it. And none of the Yemenis I spoke with this week think peace is at hand. Ahmed Jahaf is a graphic designer in the capital.
What I say is Saudis must end the war that they started without any preconditions.
Yemeni journalist Mohammed Al-Khadi tells me that the Houthis have the upper hand in this conflict.
In the beginning, you know, the government and also the Saudis and also the Saudi-led coalition, they were trying to pressure the Houthis or to defeat them. Now maybe it is the reverse.
And here's the thing about Yemen right now. The war is really a tangle of wars. There's the Saudi-led campaign against the Houthis. There's the Houthi campaign against the exiled president. And then there's a separatist movement in the south. Numerous attempts at putting a ceasefire in place have failed. For The World, I'm Stephen Snyder.
How the war in Yemen will end and what role the U.S. will play going forward remain open questions. For that, we turn to Bruce Riedel. He's advised American presidents on Middle East policy as a past member of the National Security Council.
I believe a ceasefire is possible in the Saudi war. And I think the Biden administration ought to put more pressure on Saudi Arabia to achieve that. In particular, the Biden administration should push for an immediate end to the blockade of the Houthi-controlled parts of Yemen. It is the blockade that is leading to the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today. Literally, millions of Yemenis are malnourished, and thousands of young children are going to starve to death the longer this blockade stays in effect.
We've talked a lot about this humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Basically, people are not eating, they're starving, and it is being aggravated by Saudi Arabia's blockade of all entrances to Yemen, air, sea, and land. That blockade is also seen as a big bargaining chip. So what would happen if Yemeni ports were opened again?
Well, I think Yemeni ports should be open regardless of any other linkage to other issues. The number one issue here is a humanitarian one. It's ensuring that those millions of malnourished Yemenis get access to the kind of food and medicine they need. The Saudis have actually tightened the blockade this year. Back in January, before Joe Biden was inaugurated, they took steps to make it even harder to bring food into North Yemen, where the majority of the population is. The blockade is by definition an offensive weapon. The Biden administration has said it will no longer support Saudi offensive military operations in the Yemen war. Well, this is the number one offensive military operation, and the Biden administration should tell the Saudis to immediately, unconditionally lift the blockade.
Just on humanitarian grounds?
On humanitarian grounds, simple as that. The blockade has not worked in the sense of pressuring the Houthis to accede to Saudi demands. We know that. The war is 6 years old this week. It hasn't succeeded in pressuring the Houthis to anything. The Houthis are remarkably impervious to military pressure. They're also remarkably callous about the welfare of their own citizens, their own people who live in the north. In that sense, they are a thuggish group. The Middle East is filled with thuggish groups, however, and we shouldn't signal out the Houthis any more than a lot of other militia groups across the Middle East. The imperative here is to focus on the people. The Yemeni people are dying because of malnutrition caused by the blockade. So we should get the blockade lifted and out of the way, and then go on to deal with other issues about getting ceasefires and then building reconstruction for Yemen's infrastructure, which has been badly damaged by 6 years of war.
We have to recognize that members of the Biden administration were running foreign policy when the U.S. entered the war in 2015. I'm thinking of General Lloyd Austin, who was head of CENTCOM at the time, would have been approving U.S. support for the Saudi bombing campaign. So today, how much responsibility do you think Biden and his team bear to working seriously toward peace in Yemen?
You're absolutely right. The Obama-Biden administration gave the Saudis at least a yellow light, if not a green light, to go ahead with the war. They bear responsibility for this. Mm. Rarely in life do you get a chance to go back and fix a big mistake. The Biden administration has that rare opportunity, and they should do it. They've said they intend to do it. Now is the time to follow through and get the blockade lifted and ultimately get a ceasefire to get this humanitarian disaster brought to a swift end.
Bruce, one last question as we absorb the 6 years since the start of the Saudi war in Yemen. What do you think the end of the Yemen war will realistically look like?
I think the end of this war will lead to multiple Yemens. At least a Houthi-controlled Yemen in the north, what used to be the Republic of Yemen. Some kind of government in the southern port city of Aden, where there's very strong support for independence. And then I met a hodgepodge of other little local governments across the rest of southern and eastern Yemen as local tribes hold on to power in different ways. It's going to be very messy. It's going to take a great deal of smooth operating to keep these parts from going back to war with each other. But if we can end the Saudi war and the Saudi blockade and the Saudi aerial bombardment of Yemeni cities, we will have accomplished a great deal. Those are realistic objectives that this administration can do in the next 6 months. It's pledged to do its best to end the war, and I hope they go about walking the walk as well as talking the talk.
Bruce Riedel is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was speaking with us about the Biden administration's options for supporting an end to the six-year war in Yemen. A sad anniversary, but thanks very much, Bruce, for your time and for talking about it.
My pleasure. Take care.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. An Iranian-born composer has a troubled relationship with his native country, but a terrifying encounter with the law in Iran also sparked inspiration.
Because I woke up and I could barely hear anything, and there was like all sort of these weird noises in my head, and I started to hear actual music.
Drawing beauty out of an awful situation, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. You've probably done this. You pull into an intersection, then the cars in front of you just stop, the light turns red, and then this happens. Mm-hmm, and you're the one who caused the gridlock. Now imagine you're the captain of the Ever Given, the cargo ship blocking traffic through the Suez Canal. The vessel is the length of the Empire State Building, if you stood it on its stern. It's led to memes and parodies across the globe. The internet has not had this much fun since Bernie Sanders' mittens.
Hey, mate! You can't park there! You may be constipated, but at least you're not the Suez Canal.
Whoopsies, it looks like the fact that the entirety of Earth's maritime economy is based on three tiny shipping channels is causing problems again.
So why is this canal so important? Basically, it's this massive man-made river with a pretty dubious history of slavery, war, and colonialism that runs through the skinny bit of Egypt and connects Europe to Asia.
Don't go there, cause the ship can't turn in the Suez Canal. It's blocked up for the foreseeable future, so be aware that the shops can't stock cause their stock is there.
Not the Strokes, obviously, and thank you TikTok for all of that. Okay, one more. Somebody imagining life as if they were the Ever Given.
I'm not moving. What's that? I'm blocking 10% of international trade. Don't be afraid to stand your ground. Don't let anyone push you to the side. Ooh, I'm not allowed to block off this international trade pathway. I'm not allowed to be here. According to who? Because the last time I checked, I'm my own boss.
Hashtag I'm my own boss. Okay, moving on, because seriously, this stuck ship is a major problem for world trade. It could take weeks to get the Ever Given moving again. Meantime, stuck in the Suez Canal gridlock are about 200 other ships, transporting everything from oil to food to live animals. For those captains not committed to staying in line, they can go all the way around the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, but that's a bit like following Waze, driving 20 miles out of your way to save 2 minutes, and burning a lot of fuel in the process. Bottom line, one stuck ship is a huge mess for global supply chains and for the Egyptian government, which controls the canal. So says industry editor Simon Wright, who breaks this all down for us on today's episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio.
For the Egyptian government, the canal is a big source of foreign earnings. A ship the size of the Ever Given, it might be $700,000 in tolls to go through the canal. And the country's been doing all it can to attract more business to the canal. So in 2015, Egypt spent $8 billion on an expansion project to cut waiting times. Some bits of the canal now have sort of two lanes, a bit like a motorway, but sadly not the bit where the boat is jammed. This holdup, shipping companies are going to have to think about what to do. Already last year, some vessels were taking the more circuitous route via the Cape of Good Hope. That was made possible because although it takes a week longer, very cheap fuel last year made it more attractive. The blockage might now force ships to go around that route, which will add costs and time.
That was Simon Wright, the industry editor at The Economist. As shipping companies weigh their options, security experts say they need to act fast. The ships are just floating out there, loaded with billions of dollars worth of goods in some of the world's most volatile waters. In other words, sitting ducks for pirates. On Monday, we'll have more on the security threats and piracy. One last thought for now from Dan Baer at the Carnegie Endowment. On Twitter, he said, and let me read the whole thing, "The thing I can't get over with the big boat in the Suez is how banal it is. Given the enormous complexity of global trade logistics, security, and law, this feels like the equivalent of a special forces commando who endures dangerous missions and ends up choking on a peanut." Next for you on the show, we've got another installment in our series called Movement, in which musicians tell their stories of migration. Our story today is about a classically trained composer from Iran who was oppressed by that government from birth. He's built a successful life around music and art, but has also been stalked by an unhappy relationship with a place that is supposed to be home. As always, our guide for our Movement series is musician Mikli Tadero. And a warning, there is an account of violence and torture in this piece. Please take care while listening.
Artists play the line between pain and beauty, between the hardships we experience in life and the meaning we make from it. What you're about to hear is my conversation with a musician who, perhaps more than anyone else I know, truly embodies that connection.
So I am Sahbo Aminikia. I am an Iranian composer based in San Francisco, California, and I've been living here for the last 15 years.
Sahbo's music has been performed all over the world, in Asia, Europe, South America, North America. But he still makes time to work with young musicians who are just starting out, exactly where he started out.
I have this class that I teach in Iran, belongs to this Baha'i University. I don't know if I told you about that, but it's an underground university. It's illegal for Baha'is who are deprived of education.
Am I allowed to ask you about
of
that?
Of course, yes.
Yeah. So what do you teach at this underground university?
This semester I taught counterpoint.
Wow. Yes.
So I can tell you a little bit about the background of the university, actually.
Yeah.
So Baha'is are a religious minority in Iran that are under heavy persecution for the last 2 centuries, basically. All sorts of citizen rights have been deprived of, including the right to higher education. And I come from that background. My father was one of the founders, actually, of this university, which is created by university professors, Baha'i University professors, who were fired from the university after the Islamic Revolution of 1979.
Tehran marked the end of 15 years in exile. For the people of Iran, the arrival of his jetliner signaled the beginning of...
The Islamic Revolution of 1979 overthrew the U.S.-backed dictatorship in Iran and replaced it with an Islamic Republic led by Ayatollah Khomeini.
The man who from long distance had led the revolution to topple the Shah. Inside the airport terminal,
under this new regime, Baha'is could not practice their faith in public. They could not hold government jobs or collect pensions, and as Saba said, they could not attend universities until his father and some other former professors founded an alternative.
And they created this university called BIHE that completely operates inside of private homes. I studied in it myself. They would offer an associate degree at the time.
Was that degree in music?
Yes, it was in music. And it was very interesting to see. I grew up with this perspective of kind of a diversity that exists within some sort of unity, you know. Because of the fact that Iran was blocking any sort of Western media coming into Iran, and we had to obtain this illegally, basically, from people on the street. And then in that context, the music of Philip Glass and the music of Michael Jackson would be put in the context of the same platform.
Mm.
And when you don't grow up in that environment, that there is a hierarchy to these genres, you kind of consider all of them the same thing and part of the same quality and same soul, which until this day remains with me. I love every genre of music.
So was the persecution related to your Baha'i faith part of the reason that you left Iran?
That was the only reason.
When Saba was 19, he left Iran and went to St. Petersburg, Russia, where he studied with a former student of the great composer, Dmitri Shostakovich.
I got into classical music because of Dmitri Shostakovich, because I just admire his music. And he also lived under a very totalitarian government, and that effect is very much evident in his music. That it's the music that comes from pain.
A few years later, in 2006, Saba immigrated to the U.S. as a social refugee and began studying at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. But even as he launched his career here, his music was often focused on Iran. He wrote about the little things he missed about the country where he was born. He wrote about the protests that were happening in Tehran following the election in 2009. He experimented with incorporating the actual sounds of mourning and uprising into his pieces. And his work started to get noticed. Saba debuted a string quartet with the legendary Kronos Quartet and later had his work featured at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. During those years, Saba stayed engaged with what was going on in Iran and even attended protests there. But he didn't consider himself a political person or someone the government would even want to bother with. He was able to travel back and forth and to visit family. But as it turns out, he was being noticed by the authorities in Iran.
Back in 2011, when my father actually passed away, I went to Iran for a short trip, and I was a US citizen back then. And there were three people waiting for me at the door at the where my parents live. They put a blindfold on me and handcuffed me and basically made me lie on the back of the back seat. And they started driving through the city, interrogating me, basically just asking. And the moment that he was informed that I was a Baha'i, actually, the things started to become worse. He took me to a desert outside of a city in the middle of desert, and they took me out of a car, emptied two capsules of pepper spray inside my mouth and inside my nose. Started beating me over and over again, and he asked me to tell him that I'm a Baha'i three times. And I said, why? And he said that if you say that you are a Baha'i, if you say that you're a kafir, a non-believer for three times, I have the religious right here to execute you. He put his pistol in my mouth and started counting and pulling the trigger. But there was no bullet, obviously, in the gun. But he did it several times, just giving me enough time. Just, okay, this was, and there was no bullet, and we're going to do it again and again and again. Until I don't remember, I kind of passed out, and they left a few hours. I don't even remember when exactly they left. But there was this epiphany, you know, I had, because I woke up and I could barely hear anything, and there was like all sort of these weird noises in my head, and I started to hear actual music. The second string quartet of Shostakovich, and that was exactly, this was the opening of that, and I literally started hearing music in my ears. It was a very interesting moment for me, and I cannot describe it, but it changed my life.
It's interesting, though, because you've had that experience that kind of defines the range of what human beings are or can be, and yet you are this person who is like, you just point to like bringing light to people. Like,
yeah.
You have this, you see the range, and then you're all the way over yeah. here, which is like.
As I really believe the fact that beauty comes, real beauty comes out of pain. That's what I'm looking for, people who are suffering in this world. And I would love to serve them in any way I can. And that is not something that I do to make myself feel better. It's a duty that is on the shoulder of every one of us.
Saba's most recent composition is part of an ongoing collaboration with the Kronos Quartet. It's called Nasreen's Dream.
A piece that is dedicated to Nasreen Sotoudeh. She is a human rights lawyer and an activist in Iran, and she's currently in prison. And during the time that we were working on this piece last August, September, she was in a hunger strike for 45 days. So I asked everyone around me, and I posted it on social media through activists, that we are creating a piece with Kronos Quartet, and we want everyone to send their own voice. And they should just say her name, and they can say it any way they want it. They want to cry and say it, if they want to scream the voice, is the name, if they want to sing the name. And I received around 300, 400 voices, actually, from different people. So it starts with drops of rain, and it increases with the name being said over and over again. And it's drops of rain, no matter how weak and how insignificant they are, eventually they would create a rainstorm. They would create rain, and they would wash this part of humanity. No demagogue, no dictator can resist such a force.
Nasreen And it reminds me of what you said earlier, which was also that true art comes from suffering.
I strongly believe that. That's why music exists. It's a function. It's a natural, organic response that our body has to this pain. The music that speaks to the soul comes from the soul, and the soul that is full of pain, it would sound always better. And we know that deep down as musicians.
And Saba, being Saba, ended with a big belly laugh.
That's musician and storyteller Mikli Tadero with Iranian composer Saba Amanikia. Sound mixing courtesy of Ian Koss. This story is part of a series called Movement about music and migration. We featured artists with roots in Syria, Sudan, Mexico, and Ethiopia, and collected their incredible music in a Spotify playlist. You can find details on that and the musicians' personal stories at theworld.org/movement. You're listening to The World. President Biden doubled his goal yesterday. He wants 200 million people in the U.S. vaccinated against COVID-19 within his first 100 days in office. Other countries have yet to administer a single dose. There's just not enough vaccines out there. In an effort to expand the supply in Canada, one company there is testing a rogue scheme. It wants to make a vaccine that it did not develop. As The World's Alana Gordon reports, this unusual move is adding to a fierce global debate about who controls vaccine knowledge and production during a pandemic.
For decades, the small Canadian company Biolease Pharma has specialized in making injectable cancer drugs.
We're in St. Catharines, Ontario. We have a facility here of about 125,000 square feet, and we're a tight little team.
Claude McHugh is the company's director and co-founder. When the pandemic started, he says he thought he could help.
It will take years before we can even think of vaccinating this world at the rate we're going right now. So we should leave no stones unturned.
He says BioLease could easily make COVID-19 vaccines, specifically the kind of effective single shot that Johnson & Johnson developed.
Well, we have basically the equipment. We have very large bioreactors here that could deal with an industrial production.
He estimated they could make at least 20 million doses this year. So he emailed Johnson & Johnson. They hold the patent, meaning they control who makes the vaccine, what to charge, and where it goes. The company responded to BioLease's inquiry.
And they basically wrote to us saying that they were not interested.
A Johnson & Johnson spokesperson told The World that vaccine production is complicated, and there's a limited number of places that can do this at quality and scale. Johnson & Johnson picked 11 out of about 100 companies to produce hundreds of millions of vaccines in the coming months. BioLease, which has never produced a vaccine before, was not one of them. McHugh then took an unusual step. He reached out to the Canadian government to request what's called a compulsory license. It would allow him to make the vaccine anyway and pay a fee to Johnson & Johnson. Anna Santos-Rauschman is an assistant professor of health law at St. Louis University. She says what BioLease wants to do presents a powerful case study to test out the global rules that were set up for this very scenario of responding to essential medicine shortages amid a public health crisis.
This means that something that was mostly theory or legal framework that went unused suddenly becomes a possibility. And sometimes you just need one to lead the pack, and then we can resort to this mechanism, which really has been underused by developed countries.
No country has issued a compulsory license for a vaccine in the pandemic yet. Rauschman says such a move faces lots of opposition from the European Union, the U.S., and the drug developers themselves, who are mainly based in these regions.
The concern is that if we do this with vaccines, what's next?
Could this challenge the model for developing drugs that rewards companies with exclusive rights? But the inequities of vaccine access in the pandemic has prompted more sweeping proposals. The World Health Organization created a system to encourage vaccine makers to voluntarily share their knowledge and technical know-how for making COVID-19 vaccines with other manufacturers. But so far, no company wants to share. South Africa and India have asked the World Trade Organization to lift all COVID-19 patents that would more easily allow for compulsory licensing for the duration of the pandemic. But many countries remain opposed. Kathleen Van Bremt is a Belgian member of the European Parliament. She says the growing vaccine shortages in Europe has leaders assessing all options.
We need to learn from this crisis. That's why the BioLease case is also very interesting for me. It will not deliver so much vaccines for the rest of the world or for the EU, but it's an interesting case because I want to know whether compulsory licensing is actually working. How do we make the world health system pandemic-proof?
In Canada, it's unclear whether BioLease will have much success with their application, or if they do get the green light, how long it will then take to manufacture and gain approval for their version. This specific rule has only been used once before in the country, in the mid-2000s, to make HIV medicines to export to Rwanda. Claude McCure, founder of BioLease, says he's not giving up. He's 72 years old.
We feel that we have to do something. I would pursue this till I stop working, for sure.
He wants to make history. He says the world needs all the support and vaccines it can get. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Okay, what does this remind you of? Warm summer nights, maybe, sleeping in as the rain falls. Lightning is most common in warm, humid climates, but new research suggests it may be on the rise in a place where it's far more rare, the Arctic. Rounding things out on the show today, here's The World's Anna Kussmer with a literal newsflash.
When lightning strikes, it emits radio waves. Physicist Robert Holdsworth at the University of Washington has been spotting and counting lightning strikes using those waves in the Arctic for more than a decade.
Well, in 2010, we detected 35,000, and we detected most recently something over 250,000. So there's a big increase.
That's around a 300% increase in 10 years. The question is why? In a study published this week, Holdsworth found that the strikes were correlated with something.
Lo and behold, on an individual yearly basis, there's a strong relationship between the increase in lightning and the temperature for that year.
That's average global temperature. Rising temperatures are associated with more moisture in the air and more intense thunderstorms, creating conditions for more lightning. But it's too soon to say that one is causing the other, Holdsworth says.
Temperature is not the only thing that causes thunderstorms.
Other factors influence lightning frequency, like humidity, salinity of the oceans, and air and water currents. Lightning experts around the world are looking on.
This brings a lot of questions to researchers' mind.
Antti Mäkelä is a researcher at the Finnish Meteorological Institute in Helsinki. They've been tracking lightning strikes for 20 years. He says a first look at his data doesn't show the same uptick as this new study, but he's planning to publish a fuller analysis next year. The new findings are in line with science that suggests warming temperatures will make storms more intense.
Meaning that a single thunderstorm will in the future climate produce more lightning than in the current climate.
This is important, says Mäkelä, because lightning can spark wildfires or hit people.
In the Arctic regions, there are people living. They have reindeer and other animals there living and so on. So, of course, increases in amount of lightning, it brings more threat.
The Arctic is warming at twice the rate of the rest of the world. Mäkelä says other changes, like melting snow, permafrost, and sea ice, are more worrisome. But any information about how the changing climate will impact life in the north helps them prepare. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online 24/7 at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong. We're back with you on Monday. From PRX.